Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Desert Island Graps featuring my guest, Jimmy Rave. This will be presented in a slightly different style to what you may be used to with Desert Island Graps. This is a very open conversation with Jimmy Rave, and it contains strong language and discussions of abuse, addiction, and suicide that some people may find upsetting. Jimmy Rave, how are you doing?
So today. Today's a decent day. I gotta get into my routine today, but so far so good.
What's the routine this morning?
Well, I got 2 or 3 doctor's appointments this afternoon. Dealing with that, dealing with insurance and disability. It's been a crazy
I often start these interviews by saying sort of in a jovial manner, how are you doing? But it's a funny one because like I kind of want to ask it in a different way. I want to say how you're doing in a more serious tone, because it's been it sounds cliche, but it's been a roller coaster for you, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. But I try to look at the positive things about it. You know, like I've had a lot of people reach out. I've had reconnected with a lot of people, so. I got a good support system, so.
We're here today to celebrate your incredible body of work and look at things going forward and take it from there. But a big part of today is we're sending you onto a desert island, Jimmy.
Okay.
And we're allowing you to take with you 3 wrestling matches burned onto a DVD that you would watch whilst you're there. We don't know how electricity works on this island. We haven't quite figured it out. But throughout our chat today, we'll find out what matches you would love to watch once again. And whilst you're there, what would the first match for your DVD be, Jimmy?
I think it would be the Shawn Michaels Bret Hart Iron Man match.
A hell of a match. With this one in particular, can you remember where you were when you watched it for the first time?
Oh, no. What year was that?
That was 1996, if memory serves.
1996. I was living in Washington State at the time. I was a military brat, so I moved around a lot. And we were living in Washington State, about to move to Georgia. And I had no idea that, like, maybe a year and a half later, I started training to wrestle. But it was just, you know, not in my mind yet. But it was, yeah, 1996, I was living on a farm. My nearest neighbor was like 2 miles away.
How did you find life as a military brat moving around so much at a young age?
Yeah, that's difficult because, like, you know, every year I was at a new school or whatever. But I, you know, like the thing that got me into pro wrestling was, you know, living that life because I was probably in 2nd or 3rd grade, and I was living in Hawaii at the time. And my best friend, he loved pro wrestling, and his family loved pro wrestling. And I had no idea what it was. And I went over there, and I watched maybe WrestleMania 4 with them. And the WWE only came to Hawaii once a year at the time for a house show. And I went, and it was always in December, and my birthday is December 8th. So that was my birthday present every year, was getting to go to that house show. And I remember seeing the worst finish I've ever seen in wrestling at the first house show I went to. They announced during the Hogan Slaughter feud. And they announced, you know, Hogan versus Slaughter for the title. You know, I'm a huge Hulkamaniac. And we get there and they said Hogan couldn't make it and would be replaced by Big Boss Man, which was fine by me because I was from Cobb County, Georgia anyway, you know. And I'm watching the match and Boss Man goes to the top rope, gives Slaughter the double axe handle. He pins him and I hear the bell ring and I wasn't paying attention to the ref. Well, the finish was that Boss Man was on the top rope for too long. And I've never seen that finish in wrestling in my life.
Wow. That's special. I didn't realize you can get told off for that in wrestling. I didn't realize that was a thing.
They actually stopped it maybe 10 years ago. But yeah, you couldn't be on the top rope for more than 5 seconds.
There's part of me that would hope that a promotion somewhere in 2021 would just play Silly Buggers and bring that back. Just to end a match, just to surprise people. But isn't wrestling fascinating like that? It's amazing like that, how all those years later, you can remember like beat for beat that match between Hogan and Warrior that took place on your birthday in Hawaii. What other matches do you remember seeing at these shows that came to
I remember the Rockers were there. Demolition was there. Tito Santana, like guys like that. Later in my career was like so awesome because when I first started wrestling, Demolition Axe was like a huge influence on me. Like we rode together a lot. He's from Georgia. And then I was at one point in my career, I was living in Columbus, Georgia, and was real tight with Marty Jannetty. And so like it's so weird how wrestling comes full circle sometimes.
You have to pinch yourself a little bit and go, I remember these guys when I was
yeah.
I was remember watching them and now here we are in the car together. Did you say that you rode with Demolition Axe?
Yeah.
So what was that like as an experience to jump ahead a little bit here?
Yeah, he's amazing because, you know, he actually works with youth coming out of juvenile detention centers. And, you know, he's like a real smart man, you know what I mean? Like, and later in life, I discovered Mass Superstar. And like, that's what I really loved about him was his Mass Superstar days. And he would talk to me about how when delivering promos, he would sit back and watch everybody, and everybody's yelling in their promos, he would speak to where people would have to, you know, listen. And then if everybody's doing that, he'd be going crazy, you know, and just really teaching me how to separate myself from everybody else.
Important to have someone like that on your side. To go back to Bret and Michaels WrestleMania 12, you remembered Boss Man and the Hogan match, the disqualification off the top rope, almost beat for beat there. Is there something from that Hogan and Michaels match the Bret Michaels match, the Hogan Michaels match was something different, Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels match that you remember that still brings you deep joy as a wrestling fan?
Yeah, I mean, Shawn's entrance was something that, you know, like that was the first time I ever seen anything like that. And you know, like I run a training school now, and I try to tell my students, you know, if you can capture somebody's attention right out the entrance, then it makes, you know, the match so much better. You know what I mean? Like, and that helped me when I was in Ring of Honor, like when fans would throw toilet paper at me and stuff like that. Because, like, right at my entrance, I already have them involved in the match. You know what I mean? And I remember Shawn, you know, had me at that time. And, you know, for somebody that's a younger person, watching a 60-minute match is sometimes difficult. That attention span's not there. But they were so, you know, I just watched it maybe 2 weeks ago. And the way that they paced that match was just so amazing. You know, and kept kept me involved the whole time.
When was the moment for you when you went from being invested in Michaels and Hart in the Iron Man match to realizing, actually, I don't want to just watch this. This is something I actually want to do.
Oh, that's interesting. Like I was a freshman in high school, and I was living in, like, okay. So when I moved to Marietta, Georgia, I was originally from there, but then I moved back there, right at the end of middle school. And I, this is at the height of WCW. This is like 98, 99 era. And, I remember going to baseball practice because, like, baseball was supposed to be my meal ticket, you know, like that's what I was really good at. And so I went to baseball practice one day and saw Dusty Rhodes there and lost my mind, you know what I mean? And he was like, my baseball field was right behind a school called Lassiter High School, and that's where Cody graduated from. And so he was there. Cody's baseball practice, and Cody's sister and I ended up being friends because we're in the same grade and stuff like that. So now things are starting to be like tangible for me, you know, like when I was in a farm in Washington State, like in Washington State, they didn't start running wrestling there regularly until recently, like with people like Defy and 321 Wrestle. Like that didn't start happening until recently because there was such a the commission there wouldn't let people run wrestling very well. It was so costly, so I never could get close to it. And then so I had that experience with Dusty, and then after football practice one day, I saw a flyer at my high school for pro wrestling, and I went to that match and. And then after that, I was done for. I also went to the same high school as Buck Bagwell. So, like, and then Xavier Woods went there after
this was Sprayberry High, wasn't it? Seems like a lot of people that you had, the Rhodeses over the way. You had Buff Bagwell, you had Austin Creed. There's a good wrestling fraternity here. I think that had it, even if you hadn't seen Dusty, it might have ended up that way anyway for you.
Yeah. Well, you know, Jimmy Yang went to a high school that was.
No way.
Yeah, I mean, there was a good amount of wrestling going on at that point.
That's a hell of a promotion, just you lads. That's a hell of a company that is. You said there baseball was originally your meal ticket.
Yeah. Yep.
What got you into baseball?
Baseball, you know, like I said, I grew up in like a farm town, and you know, you either played a sport or sat at home and played video games, and I tried to do both, you know what I mean? So, so baseball was just something I fell in love with, and I could, remember statistics and stuff like that. It's the same kind of obsession I grew into wrestling. And then I realized, especially when I got to Marietta, there were so many good baseball players that came out of that area too, that you really have this team behind you. And if the team doesn't work well, then you don't get noticed as much, you know? And with pro wrestling, it was all on my shoulders if it didn't work out. So I'd rather take that chance than, you know, hope these guys will do good for me.
I was going to say, had wrestling not come along, do you think that you would have pursued a baseball career with the same sort of vigor and energy that you've pursued a wrestling career?
Absolutely. I would have probably been a baseball coach right now. Like, just like I'm a wrestling coach right now, you know what I mean? Like, one of those kind of things.
Getting into wrestling, it was Murder One that started your training. You started your training in wrestling. Talk to me about that first day when you go into training school. Like, what is it you breathe when you walk into that for the first time?
Yeah, my mom passed away when I was 16. So this was just right before she passed away. And I remember she took me there. She saw me do it, and she was super supportive of it. But that first day was, it's just like everybody else's first day. You know, like I'm on the verge of throwing up. I've got bruises everywhere. You know, the ropes are killing me, you know, all that stuff. And, you know, and Murda one of the time was doing, like, he was in that ECW kind of circle. Like, New Jack would be around often during my training. And so, you know, we were pushed really hard and everything was like super stiff. And it wasn't like all the old wrestlers in Georgia, you know what I mean? We were taking wrestling super seriously.
What was something you learned in your first few days of wrestling training that surprised you about wrestling?
Really just the fraternity aspect of wrestling. Because soon after I started, they had me go on the road with them and helping set up rings and stuff like that. And I realized that there was some guys that were really after it and some guys that were, you know, like I tell people, like, you can have veterans that have been wrestling for 20 years, but you know, there's three types of those. There's the veterans that wrestle once a month. There's some that wrestle once a week. And then there's some that wrestle every day of the week, you know? And I didn't want to be the ones of the guys that were wrestling once a month for 20 years. You know what I mean? And then we ran into a lot of those.
You wanted to throw yourself into it constantly.
Yeah, absolutely. I, like, at one point I was wrestling three shows on a Saturday in three different towns.
Well, how do you get through a run like that? Obviously it's the passion that does it, but you must be spent body wise by the time the week rolls around again.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but I was like 16, 17. Yeah. So like, you know, it's not like now where, and you know, the other part, you know, the biggest part, I never was somebody that had a lot of injuries in pro wrestling. Like, my knees are good. You know, I don't have any nagging, you know, shoulder injuries or elbows or anything like that. But like, so I always felt like I wrestled smartly. But, you know, at that time I was still trying to moonsault off of stuff and do crazy stuff. It was the, you know, like I said, the era of ECW. So we were trying to emulate that stuff. And, you know, it would take a toll on me. I remember driving home like 4 hours with a broken right ankle and trying to hit the pedal. And just every time I hit the pedal, it like killed me. And, but I went to my regular job the next day, you know what I mean? Like, and then did it all again the following weekend.
What was the regular job at that point?
I got real fortunate. Like, when I turned 17, I started running an admission station. Do you know who that is?
Is it not like a petrol station or a gas station?
It's similar to that. We would test cars to make sure they weren't emitting a lot of emissions.
Right, okay.
And right. So by the time I was 17, I had my own station. And so I was doing well at a real young age. And so I did that all the way up until 2007.
And that day when you said, I can't do this, the emissions job anymore because wrestling's taking over full time, that must have been a great moment to get to that.
It was point. Until the very next week.
But initially.
So, yeah, it was amazing. I was like, you know, I was at the point where I'm making enough wrestling money not to have to do this anymore. You know, I was always real smart with money too. Like I would open another business on the side while I was wrestling. So I always had something to fall back on, you know? But like I owned a staffing agency at one point. I owned a cheerleading gym at one point. Like I would always have these other things to fall back on. But the day that I was able to like quit my like 9 to 5 was awesome. And then I wrestled Samoa Joe that weekend and he went to kick me in the chest and broke my jaw. And I ended up, And now I don't have an income. You know what I mean? Because the Ring of Honor contracts at the time were, if you don't wrestle, you don't get paid. You know, and so I ended up wrestling with a broken for 5 weeks. And then I did that all the way until I wrestled Nigel McGuinness in the UK, in Liverpool.
That's it seems ridiculous to people now who would hear that and say, I broke my jaw, but I carried on for as long as I could until I couldn't. Like, would you tell yourself different now? Would you have gone about that in a different way? Had you know now had you known then what you know now?
I mean, honestly, no, I would probably have done the same thing. Not because of anything more than I believe in wrestling so much that I wanted to finish the thing with Nigel. Mm. And we couldn't have done it anywhere other than Liverpool. You know what I mean? And like, that's, you know, like I hold so close to me, like the kayfabe aspect of wrestling as much as I can, that I would have done it all over again, the same thing.
Is there something that Murder One taught you in particular that you teach your students today? And is there something that Murder One taught you that you choose not to teach to your students today?
Yeah. So the thing that I teach that Murder One taught me was the hustle of wrestling. You know, it's just like any other entertainment industry where you have to have, you know, you have to make your own t-shirts and this and that and promote yourself in different ways, you know, different websites. You know, I didn't have Facebook all the way up until like 2013 or something crazy like that. Like, and he was like, why aren't you on MySpace? Like, when that was a thing, you know what I mean? Like those kind of things. And, the thing I don't teach now, and it's not just Murder One, but like a cultural wrestling thing, is like, I don't beat the shit out of my students. You know what I mean? Like, back in the day, I kind of grew up in the still wild, wild west of wrestling. But my third match ever, I wrestled a guy from the power plant, and he thought I was too young or too skinny or something, and he broke my arm, intentionally. And, you know, like, I don't teach that to my students. And, you know, like, being a coach these days, or even just a mentor towards younger wrestlers, is a lot like, you know, I ended up getting in the mental health and substance abuse field, helping people. And it's a lot like the same thing. Like, I have to know how I can approach each person. Some people really respond well to me yelling at them or pushing them that way, you know, and other people I have to gently talk to.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Got another match to choose, Jimmy. So we've had the first match for your DVD. It's Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels from WrestleMania 12. What would you like your second match to be, sir?
I would choose AJ Styles versus Christopher Daniels from the NWA 52nd anniversary, the first time they wrestled each other.
Wow. What is it about that? Well, before we get into what it is, where were you when you first...
I was there. I rode down with AJ. Right. And he had never met Christopher Daniels before. And I had already been doing stuff, and he had just left WCW, and TNA wasn't a thing yet. And like, this was going to be the match that, you know, from that match, he got the matches at the Super 8, you know, Ring of Honor, the best of Super Indies, you know, that kind of stuff.
What is it with that match that, that inspires you even to this day?
Just knowing the mutual respect that they had for each other. And I felt like that energy pushed them both to be, have this match that would, Christopher Daniels didn't need AJ Styles, you know what I mean? But AJ kind of needs that rub still. And, but AJ was the kind of guy that was going to go out there and produce anyway, you know? And so I think they just drove off of each other and have continued to do so their whole career. Like, they have that drive off of each other. And so, yeah, like that whole night was a memorable night. Like, that was the night that Hashimoto beat Carino for the world title. And there was a very work shoot aspect of it, you know, like, Carino ended up like leaving the ring before, you know, the bell had rang. It was just a real good, you know, atmosphere. And there was so many just pro wrestlers there that that's the thing that I value too, is like when pro wrestlers can suspend their own disbelief, you know what I mean? And everybody's at the curtain watching, and then they feel that same thing that fans are supposed to feel. I value that completely. And I've had those moments in my career, and I know how it feels to come back from that.
I think every time you go to a show like that, you always meet new people. Was there somebody that you met for the first time at that anniversary show? And do you remember the interaction that you had with them?
Yeah, it was probably Roderick Strong. I'd been going down to Florida a bit, but he was kind of an asshole. Yeah, I mean, he still is kind of an asshole, but he was my best. He's been my best friend for most, like, a lot of my career. But he's like that little brother that's always going to poke you the extra time to make you want to kill him. And I remember meeting him there. I remember meeting Stan Lane there. Like, there was just a good group of young, hungry guys and guys that were like veterans, like Buck Quartermain, stuff like that. There was always that good sense in Tampa of that kind of circle.
Describe the vibe in the car, because you say you travel down with them. Describe the vibe in the car heading to the show compared to the vibe on the way back from the show.
There was just a lot of anxious energy on the way, you know. The other thing was, is AJ and I both came from a company called NWA Wildside. We both were in that company for a long time. And we knew that we were going to do a big angle at the end of the show where we jumped all the Florida guys. And there was only a few people that were like in the know of it, you know? And so there was that nervous energy then, because some people started throwing live rounds sometimes. And, but on the way home, everybody was just, you know, not even just like me, but my other friends that were from the Wild Side, we were all so happy for AJ, that, you know, like, there was just this excited, you know, we knew that we were on the, something big was about to happen.
With some people, you can sense that, can't you? That there's big things afoot with him. And as there was with many of you as well. Where did the name Jimmy Rave come from? What's the story behind the name?
You know, like at the late 90s, there was still like a big rave scene and where I grew up at. And so that was kind of the thing. And then once that fizzled out, I didn't want to change it, you know? I'm somebody that, you know, I really feel like people need to stick with something over and over. Like I tell a lot of the kids that I mentor, like, don't change your music every show, because then people can't relate to that. You know what I mean? And then, I didn't want to like build up this, you know, equity in that name and then change it and then have to start all the way over again, you know? So ended up keeping it.
If you hadn't gone with Jimmy Rave, was there other potential names that you might have gone with?
Oh, no, I didn't even think about that. Like, I didn't even think about that. Like, I watch a lot of student stuff, like young wrestlers coming out. I watch like a lot of AEW Dark and a lot of those talents that I've helped out there, you know. And I've ran across so many people that have a better real name than their wrestling name. You know, like Easy Money. His name was Jason Justice, I believe.
Oh, you know, and nice.
You know, and then like I would always be like, your name's so much better than your wrestling name, and then you don't have to give it away when you get signed somewhere. You know what I mean?
So I didn't know he was Jason Justice. That seems,
yeah.
Well, not there's anything wrong with Easy Money, but certainly Jason Justice is a powerful name. It's a powerful name.
Right.
But we're here to talk about the powerful name that is Jimmy Rave, which. This your journey led you to Ring of Honor. We've briefly touched on some of the stuff that you did in Ring of Honor, but how did you come to sign with ROH in the first place? What's the story there?
Okay, so I'll give you the extended version, but it's kind of so like when like I always say like back in my day, like I feel so old saying that, but like we used to have to send out VHS tapes with a resume and an 8x10 because there wasn't YouTube at the time. So I remember sending out like 50 of those. I was the NWA World Junior Heavyweight Champion at the time. And, you know, the NWA world title holders would have to get booked out to all these companies. And so I sent out 50 of these VHS tapes and I only got one call back. And it was from Ian Rotten to do the Ted Petty Invitational in 2002. And I was doing Wild Side. I was doing NWA TNA's weekly pay-per-views at the time. So I'm showing up on a little bit of TV. But then AJ and I both got booked on that Ted Petty. And like there was just so much talent on there. There was AJ, Christopher Daniels, Mr. Anderson, Colt Cabana, Super Dragon, Ace Steel, CM Punk, BJ Whitmer. It was just the who's who of wrestling at the time. And but I had a real good match with Chris Hero in the second round. And after that, the company that was filming for it was Smart Mark Video. Well, Mike Burns, who was the head of Smart Mark Video, was booking for CZW at the time. And so he brought me into CZW. And then that got me a little bit closer in that Philadelphia market. And then Gabe Sapolsky and I had a couple of messages back and forth. But then I ended up just driving myself up one day, which was like 14 hours for just to introduce myself. Like I had no... You know, like there was like never any like you're going to get a match or anything. I just went to introduce myself. And then I ended up getting a match that night against AJ Styles. And then after that, 2 months later, I was pretty much full time.
I think it's a valuable lesson in taking a chance on yourself. And I think a lot of people listening to this won't appreciate the fact that you well and truly risked popping a shoulder out by delivering as many VHS tapes as you did. The carrying those would have been heavy. You can't complain. No one is allowed to complain about sending too many emails because emails don't weigh anything. But sending those out and then the whole thing of driving on a chance to meet somebody and ending up there with AJ Styles. Talk to us about that moment when you're backstage and you've had the meeting and they said, all right, you and AJ then in a couple of hours, yeah. Here we go. What goes through your head then, Jimmy?
I was relieved because it was someone I was familiar with, you know, because I could have been with anybody. I could have been with like Dan Moff and Steve Mack could have killed me. And this was Philadelphia. This was the Murphy Rec Center. And so people are fired up. It was December of 2002. So the company was still just in its infancy, but they packed that place out. And, you know, it was my job to make AJ look good because it was for the Ring of Honor television show that they had briefly at that time. And, you know, we went out there and then he ended up giving me a couple moves in the match that got the crowd hype. And, you know, I really thought it would be like my experiences with TNA where I would go up there, I'd lose and then never get a call back or get a call back 3 weeks later just to do the same thing. But, you know, they were real happy with everything. And you know, like I was elated after that.
How autonomous were you in Ring of Honor in terms of the stuff that you did creatively? Because obviously you were involved with the embassy and a bunch of other stuff there that you did. And how much of that was down to you and how much of that was directed for you?
Well, I had a very good relationship with Gabe. Like, I would talk to him daily. Like, this was back when AOL Instant Messenger was around. And so, like, I would be talking to Gabe and Punk on the regular. And Punk, like, CM Punk had a lot to do with me having a longer run. You know, especially he, you know, like, he stuck his neck out to do the angle with me. Which I felt like helped me a ton. But Gabe was super receptive to all of us that were regulars. You know, like he would lay stuff out. And then if you had some minor tweaks, he'd listen to you and like, you know, maybe scrap something but like there was so many. Gabe Sapolsky for me is a booking genius. I don't say that just to be a kiss ass or just because he helped my booking, but like I remember he was because I've been in the creative role since 2011 now. Like I wrote television for a company in Atlanta for like 3 years, you know. You know, I've helped CZW for the last 2 or 3 years. I know the difficulties of being a creative person, but Gabe would book me in a, like I was booked in an angle with AJ Styles and CM Punk at the same time. And they were both main event angles. And the way he would structure them, they never overlapped. It was never like a tag match with me and somebody versus AJ and Punk. It was when AJ was around, I'd be with AJ, and when Punk was around, I'd be with Punk, you know? And it just, the way it culminated after, like, and it helped me a ton because I would be finishing up one in the middle of the other. And so, like, I'd be in a main event, boom, and then 2 months later, be in another main event, boom, you know? And he was just really good about doing that. And I remember during Bryan Danielson's title run, how he did all these 60-minute draws. And everybody thought each night with whoever he was with, he could lose, you know? And I know that was a lot of Brian and Gabe, but and I can tell you some about Brian's mind that would that I think is, like, amazing, too. Like, that's helped, you know, not only – me and Ring of Honor, but like all these guys in WWE that are there now.
Well, you hear stories now of him working behind the scenes and pushing for guys from NXT to come and work on the roster with him. And there's a great relief as a wrestling fan where if someone's being called up to work with Daniel Bryan, you know they're going to be all right.
Right, right.
You know they're in good hands.
He, like, I was there, you know, like I said, from the very beginning. And then I didn't have a world title match until the 4th anniversary show against him. And I remember we were just like we sat down with each other. And then soon after that, Gabe was like, I need you guys to go now because somebody's flight's late, you know? And so we're like, oh shit, like we got to get together real quick. And Brian was so smart that he was like, okay, when I beat you, I'm going to beat you with the elbows. You know, like he was doing the elbows and guys were tapping out to that. And he goes, but I don't want you to tap out. I want you to pass out. And that was the first time we did a pass out thing in Ring of Honor where he's elbowing me and Todd Sinclair stopped it like in the UFC. And when we got to the back, he goes, you know, that finish leaves you open to saying like you didn't quit, you didn't get pinned, so we can keep doing this, you know? And like that's a valuable thing that nobody else thinks about. And that wasn't from Gabe, that was from Brian, you know what I mean? Like Gabe knew who to let drive when they needed to be in the steering wheel, you know?
Talk about leaving Ring of Honor in 07. Now, obviously, shortly after you left, you turned up in TNA Wrestling in a more permanent role. Was that connected or was there other things afoot there?
There was a lot of other things that were going on. I wasn't right with like substance abuse at the time, like was a big factor in it. Also, there was some things about my contract that happened the day that I quit. I took it on somebody's word that I would be on most of the shows. And I came back from Japan and they're like, oh, we need you off these next four shows because we have some Japanese talent coming in. And I was like, the way their contract was structured at the time was not guaranteed. So like, if you didn't wrestle, you just didn't get paid, you know what I mean? And they didn't owe you nothing. They just could tell you where you could go and where you couldn't go. And, I was coming back from that jaw injury and I felt like I deserved to, you know, cause I sat on the sidelines for that, you know? So that was one thing. And then, the night that I quit, I was wrestling in a four-way. Now keep in mind, I just came back from a jaw injury. Right when I came back from a jaw injury, we did a stupid match where Ace Steel hit me in the head with a cowbell and it caused me to get seven staples in my head. And then the next week after I came back from the jaw injury, like maybe the second match, BJ Whitmer powerbombed me in the turnbuckle. We bumped heads and I had to get stitches, you know? And like I said, they're not paying for my health insurance. You know what I mean? And these aren't like just things that I can make up, you know what I mean? Where I could say, oh, my back hurts. And like, there's no real, you know, way to prove that. But these are things that I'm actually going through. And then that night, somebody hit me in my eardrum and I started bleeding out my ear and ruptured my eardrum. And I was just like, I've had it. Like, I can't do this anymore.
Do you feel like if you had your time again, you might have signed off in 2007 in a slightly different way?
I would have approached the situation differently. Yeah. What happened was I went to a room and the powers that be came into the room and I was like, yo, give me a few minutes, you know, and they wouldn't. And then I was like, you know what? Fuck this. I want my release. You know what I mean? And they granted it to me right there. But it was just one of those things where I was, if I had gotten a time to cool down, I would have been okay. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. You were hot at the time and you reacted in the heat of the moment, which you know what? It's the human condition. It's kind
yeah,
of,
absolutely.
We're all a bit like that sometimes, aren't we? We all are. But you weren't, you weren't quiet for long because you turned up in TNA Wrestling. Talk to us about the Rock and Rave infection and how all that came to pass and the fun that you had doing that.
I back in 2005, I was on a flight with, I was booked to wrestle AJ Styles on, we were doing that match on a whole bunch of different promotions. And this promotion in New Jersey booked myself versus AJ Styles and Vince Russo in his corner, right? And I ended up sitting next to Vince Russo on the flight. And, you know, he's talking to me about everything. And he was wanting to start doing these religious shows based on the Bible. Have you ever seen the Ring of Glory?
Ring of Glory. Yeah, I've seen them. They're sort of like in an assembly hall, and there's always like a character that's like a humble carpenter type who comes out at the end and gets the pop. It's an interesting watch. It is an intriguing watch.
Well, he was looking for buildings to do that at, and my ex-wife was a commercial real estate agent. And so I was helping him do that and then doing those shows. But then he lost his job at TNA. Then he came back to TNA in 2006, and he started emailing me, and he was like, hey, I've got an idea for you. Could you come in and do it? I was like, yeah, if you want. And they never pulled the trigger. And originally I was going to come in to be part of VKM with Road Dogg and Billy Gunn. And I was going to be in the X-Pac role where I was doing most of the bumping and stuff like that. X-Pac was having his own problems at the time or whatever. And then I just never heard back from that. Later in life, I found out that Billy and Road Dogg shot it down because they never had seen me wrestle before. Mm. And then I actually quit Ring of Honor and was about to go to WWE. I was going to sign with WWE. I had tryout matches like 3 weeks later. And they had that Deep South developmental center in Georgia where I lived. And so that's what I was looking at. But they were going to only pay me $500 a week. And I was making $500 a night at Ring of Honor. You know what I mean? So like, I couldn't. That just didn't make sense to me, you know? And then as it got closer, Bill Behrens, who was my agent at the time, called me and said, hey, TNA will put you on pay-per-view this weekend and sign you if you're interested. And I was like, all right, that's cool. And like, they just randomly put me with Lance Hoyt and Chris Niemi. And we weren't the Rock and Raven Infection until like 3 months later.
You were just put together as a team, and the name came along shortly afterwards.
The name came along because I was working there without a contract, and I was getting scared. Like, okay, like if we keep getting beat and I don't have a contract, then I'm going to get fired. And so I saw Jeff Jarrett's kids playing rocking or Guitar Hero backstage, and it was a big popular thing backstage at the time. And so I pitched it to one of the agents, and they helped us out with it.
Amazing. I didn't know that was the story behind the name. Inspired by Guitar Hero. That's stunning. Stunning.
Well, you know, like, and, you know, I had ways to justify it. I was like, you know, Christy, I mean, she's in a real band.
Yeah.
And she can actually sing very well. And so I was trying to lend that out to it. I had other ideas, but they would like kibosh them like right off the way. Like me and D'Lo Brown he was an agent there, you know? And he was like, you know, the toilet paper thing for Ring of Honor is so great. Like, we need to figure out a way to do it here. And I said, what if we have like girls like throwing their hotel room keys into the ring and panties and stuff like that. And we did that on a explosion one night. We actually had two girls jump the guardrail and tackle us. And it just made it, you know, like I was saying, like that entrance thing much more involved. And, you know, nobody wanted to put the time and effort in it. And like Lance and I would come up with ideas for merch. Like Motor City Machine Guns had the dog collar tags. They had the dog tags. And so like we were like, oh, what if we make like backstage passes for the Rock and Rave Infection, you know? And they just, you know, they just bucked everything.
That must have been quite demoralizing when you feel like you've got something that you can roll with, and for whatever reason constantly get shut down.
Yeah, I went there coming off of a tour of Dragon Gate, And whenever I would work for Drag, like one time I was on tour for them and we wrestled 19 days in a row with no breaks and at a different city every night. And that's what I was used to in Ring of Honor, where you're wrestling 20 or 30 minutes a night. Now I'm doing these tag matches that are 5 minutes with entrances. You know what I mean? So it's really only 3 minutes. And it wasn't fulfilling to me. You know what I mean? Like, I was literally just there to get a paycheck.
I feel like we keep coming back to this, Jimmy, the whole, like, had I known then what I know now type situation. But with WWE offering you $500 a week, TNA saying, hey, short-term gratification, we'll put you on television, put you on pay-per-view this week. Do you think if you'd known where you'd have gone and what would have been ahead of you, would you have said no to that short-term buzz of being on pay-per-view and maybe consider the Deep South offer more or not? Or is it just a case of it was financially viable?
I would have gotten fired in Deep South.
Yeah.
Not just because it was hard to be around Bill DeMont, but like because they were still wanting big guys. They still wanted everybody to be like 6'2", you know, 220. And like, I just have never been built that way. You know what I mean? And I just wasn't willing to compromise like my morals to like just be on steroids all the time and be like, you know, screw it. That's what I'll do, you know? And cause I had done that in the past, trying to get a job and it just didn't work and it made my life miserable. And so, and plus my friends that were there were telling me it's not fun. You know what I mean? And like, regardless of not being able to have like amazing matches in TNA, I still had fun there because my friends were there, like Alex Shelley, Chris Sabin, Xavier Woods, Petey Williams was my roommate the whole time I was there. He's an amazing person. Sanjay Dutt, Jay Lethal. And like we'd have amazing matches on house shows that nobody ever saw. Like, I don't know if it was how Lance structured his contract or not, but I would be on most of the house shows and he wouldn't. And so I would be able to have these X Division matches and stuff like that on house shows. Like at first, when I first got there, I felt like Dutch Mantel, who was one of the writers, didn't like much. And once I started doing house shows and he was the agent, he saw what everybody else was seeing, that I could have great matches. And the one thing that Terry said to me when he offered me my contract, he goes, what can you bring to TNA? And I said, I can have good matches with anybody, and whether if I win or lose, I'll still be over, you know? And that leaves everything open to, like, I can lose every night, which we did. We lost all the time. And, like, we would still get great reactions in front of a live crowd.
You know, I don't mind losing, you know, I can still get over, but if I can win a couple of times, that would be nice.
Yeah, right.
Give me a little bit of something. Were you relieved when, it sounds like a weird thing to say when it's a job, no one's ever relieved to lose a job, but were you relieved when your release came through?
So I've just have been so lucky in wrestling. The day that they, the day before they fired me, no, the day of they fired me, Adam Pearce was booking for Ring of Honor and he goes, hey, we have this big show. It's the 7th anniversary show. We'd like for you to come back. And I was like, oh yeah, that's awesome, man. Like I can definitely do that. Let me just call the office and make sure it's okay. I called Terry Taylor. They said it's okay. Terry Taylor calls me like 3 or 4 hours later and was like, hey, we're going to end up giving you your release. And I was like, is this because I asked for the Ring of Honor thing? He's like, no, like, and I knew that Sanjay and Petey had gotten released the day before, and they had already told me. And I was on my way to a house show for TNA when they fired me. And then they were like, we just want you to do one more match. The door's open for you to come back, but we're going to do this off-the-wagon challenge, and whoever gets pinned can't come back, and we're going to pin Lance. And I was like, okay. but like right now I can do whatever I want. And he goes, yeah. So I called Pierce back and I was like, hey man, I can do a lot more than that one, you know? And he was like, all right, we'll do something. And then we had that amazing thing at the 7th anniversary where Prince Nana and Bison Smith were in the ring. I do my return and the crowd goes nuts. We're beating up Brian Danielson, and then Colt Cabana's music comes on and he clears house, you know, because he had gotten fired the same day from WWE.
So it was just like, it just felt like a homecoming for everybody involved with Ring of Honor.
Absolutely.
You were there for a year and some demons came back. Did the demons really go away though, Jimmy?
No, absolutely not.
No.
It just got uncontrollable by that point. Like I did something real stupid. I ended up having like a back surgery and wrestled 2 days later, you know what I mean? And you know, it was the same. I was in the same spot where I was like, if I don't wrestle, I don't get paid. Even though I had another business on the side, I just wasn't taking care of myself, you know?
Do you think it was justification? Saying, well, I have to wrestle. In saying that, well, even though you had another business, you said, well, I have to wrestle, otherwise I don't get paid. So I guess I have to take medication to make sure that I do.
It was a lot of more of this is what I want to be doing, you know what I mean? And like, I always felt like I could control it, and then it would just, I'd hit a slippery slope, you know what I mean? Or I would get a bad injury, and then, and you have to take more, and, or I would be around people that were doing it, you know, and, the way I used to justify it was, you know, like some of my friends at TNA would go out and party, like at the local bar or whatever. And I would always go back to my room and just be by myself playing video games, maybe somebody come in and play video games or whatever. And so like, I wasn't out there being like a fool about it, you know, like, man, I remember one time we went to the, hotel and, he's great now. He's amazing now, but, we saw Kurt Angle in the lobby with just his boxers on, like wobbling around, taking pictures with fans, you know? And I was like, you know, like, I'm not like that. You know what I'm saying? Like, so that's how I justify it. But I'd be like that at home or something, you know?
Talk to us about that, about Kurt Angle in his boxers in the lobby. Did he just turn up? Did he just walk out?
Yeah. I mean, I always blame TNA for like how bad, you know, Kurt had that point in WWE around 2005 or whatever, where they were like, you know, you have to go to rehab or we're going to fire you. And then they let him go and he came to TNA. And what I always heard was he got the same deal that Sting got, you know. The rumor was that Spike TV would manage Sting's contract. And you get $500,000 a year. You don't only have to appear on pay-per-view and TV. Well, Kurt Angle apparently got the same contract, but had to appear on everything. So they're, you know, he's on every house show. And like, I remember when I first got there, I was like, man, Kurt and Christian like would have these fucking killer matches on every house show, like in just amazing 30-minute matches, you know? And I was like, and then I started seeing him walking and like the atrophy of his arms and stuff. And like, it's, you know, it's sad, you know, seeing him walk like that.
You said when you told us first just a moment ago about the Kurt Angle thing, you kind of compared yourself to him and said, well, I'm not like
that. Oh, yeah.
I'm not like that.
Yeah, I would be like that at home. And that was my justification. Like, I'm not out in public being an idiot, you know?
That's the,
you know, I'm sure there was times that I was.
Was there, and you've talked about this in plenty of other interviews. You've been very open about your painkiller addiction. What was the moment where you went, all right, this is out of control now, and I need to do something?
I had a suicide attempt, and I think when I came out of that was one of the time that I, because I've had two moments in my life where I was like, that's it, you know. And both of them, the first time I had a suicide attempt, I didn't get help for it, and so I still had this resentment for my ex-wife, you know, and people around me, like even my friends in wrestling were like kind of backing off because they could see like this dark side of me coming out, you know what I mean? Like just not being happy with anything, whether it was wrestling or just general life. And then I got help for that. Like I got help for that at the end of 2009. And then a couple years later, I was the director of my own treatment center. I helped people with substance abuse and mental health. And it was a 24-hour center where we would help people. And so I did that for a couple of years. And then I moved up in that industry where I was working for the whole state of Georgia, where I was helping all the hospitals get better and everything. And then, so that was like a good long run of that. And then I had something happen that like caused me to slip up and have to go back to rehab again. And like I was sexually abused as a young person, like when I was between 3 and 6. And my uncle was the one that abused me. And he's been in prison for doing it to two other kids for a long time. Well, my grandmother ended up sending him pictures of myself and my 6-year-old son at the time. And he sent me a letter. And like, after I read that letter, I flipped out then too. And just cause I hadn't been dealing with that, you know what I mean? Like I was dealing with everything else in my life, but not that. And so, then I had another suicide attempt. And then I was in the ICU for a while. And then I went to a mental health hospital for a while. And then I ended up just having like a year long run of going back to painkillers until I was just like, I can't do this anymore.
What was the letter?
The letter was him telling me that I was a sinner and I needed to forgive him. Jeez. And so like, you know, that's hard to deal with. And like, I didn't know, you know, my grandmother had passed away. She passed away recently, but at that time, she had had a brain aneurysm. And so she wasn't doing things normally. You know what I mean? And I don't know if, you know, like, and I didn't know where to place my anger with that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm still hurt by him, but I thought I dealt with that. But now am I mad at her? But it was hard to be mad at her because she had her brain aneurysm. You know what I mean? Like, so I didn't know where to place my anger, you know? And sometimes I would just be angry at myself about it. You know what I mean? And like, I could deal with that. You know, like I can numb that, but other people's anger is like still there. You know what I mean?
What did you do to overcome that in the end?
Working with people that have like substance abuse and mental health, like I knew what I needed to be doing, you know, like that was my job. And so I needed, not to have the drugs in my system. So I got that taken care of. But then I found a great therapist. And that's what really helped me out was going to therapy. But my therapist was also a psychiatrist. And so there's not many psychiatrists that do talk therapy and psychiatry. But he did, and so he was able to help me get over that block. And but like, I caught him like when he was like 78 and still working, and so like, you know, I had a mental health scare when he retired. You know what I mean? Like stuff like that. It's just a lot to deal with.
Where were you in your life and in your recovery when you returned to Ring of Honor for the third time in 2013?
Oh, I was in a bad spot then. Yeah. Yeah. That was right after the letter. And I was taking not only what I normally had taken for painkillers, but like I had a bad psychiatrist that was giving me Xanax, and I'd black out, you know, like it was just a bad situation altogether. And yeah, that's the second time I went to treatment, because like that caused a lot of things to happen. Like I ended up getting a divorce, you know, a whole bunch of bad things happened after that.
What was the, can you remember the moment where you left Ring of Honor again? Like, what was the conversation like? What was the mood like with this happening once again?
It was actually a positive thing. Like I had a lot of my friends around me saying like, hey, we just want you to go get better first. You don't need to be out here doing this if you're not well, you know? And I think there was like, you know, 8 or 10 of them that were in, you know, we were all in a locker room privately talking about it and, you know, being honest about not only what I was doing, but other people were doing. And, you know, it was a loving thing that they did. And I already knew that I needed to do that. You know what I mean? Like, but sometimes you have to have those situations to happen.
How did it feel after being a part of TNA, being a part of Ring of Honor, and being in a place where you still work quite through recovery? You went back on the independent circus. What was the mood for you? How were you feeling at that time with a selection of work with Dragon Gate and places like that? Was wrestling still as important, or was it more about getting better at this point?
It's, you know, like I took a lot of time off that time. I didn't rush right back, you know, and like that's what I had done before. I'd rushed right back. And so when I finally came back, you know, it had been like 6 months, and that's the longest I'd ever taken off in my career, you know? And so I still needed that connection to wrestling in some way. Like even when I was off for those 6 months, I still had people I would talk to. I'd keep up with wrestling. But I just wasn't there active in it, you know? And so the biggest thing for me was when I came back to make sure that I was doing everything I needed to do before I got back. Like I'd go and see my therapist on Thursdays, because I knew I was wrestling Friday, Saturday, and Sunday probably. You know, I would, you know, I had some people that were in a recovery group that I would call right after the matches, you know, because, you know, sometimes that was the, you know, you get this natural high from wrestling and then you have to come down from that. And so, you know, I would have, you know, call people on my way home, you know, even if it wasn't somebody in recovery, if I could call somebody, just so I got to my house, I'd be fine. And so like, that's just what I've been doing the last however many years.
I think people don't realize that. And it is when you come away from wrestling shows, from doing stuff in front of like a live crowd, there is that endorphin rush that comes from it. And then all of a sudden you go from being watched and the sort of the focus of so many people's attention is suddenly being on your own. And it's that drop that so many struggle with. And it's things like making a phone call on your way home, just things that kind of put your head in a different place. Mm-hmm. And that seems to have been the trick. Who would you normally call on a way home? I know you say it's not always the same people, or
you know, I had different people. My best friend, his name's Sauronaro. I'd call him often. I had another kid that I trained named Kyle Matthews. And recently, you know, if I go on a long road trip, like those are the hard ones, or the, you know, the long, long road trips. But like I could see that coming. And so like I would do all through my career, I always wanted to bring people along with me. You know what I mean? Like if I could get my buddy Sal booked on a show, you know, like that's how he was in Ring of Honor for a long time. Like if I could get anybody else on something, I would do that. And so this past time when I started to travel again a couple of years ago, I have a group of guys in pro wrestling called Young, Dumb, and Broke. There's a guy named Jordan Oliver who's doing big things right now. Griffin McCoy, Ellis Taylor, and Charlie Tiger. Well, they're my students, but now that I can now I can get them on shows, and so like now I can just ride with them. You know what I'm saying? And like that's a way to keep myself accountable. That kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Because like at some point in pro wrestling, that stopped. You know, back in the day, remember how I said I used to ride with Matt Superstar Bill Eadie? At some point that stopped, like there, and not even just like physically riding with each other, but like I'd be in the car with, you know, say three or four other guys, and the driver would be driving and the guys in the back would have their headphones on. And like, I'm like, you can't learn that way. You know, like I learned a lot by just listening to these older gentlemen, like talk about their careers. You know, and so like that doesn't happen as much now.
No, there's a camaraderie that is somewhat lost.
Yeah, yeah.
On the road, which I think is still very important. A lot of people will be familiar with yourself, Jimmy. You retired at the end of last year, mm-hmm. And for one, I'm really grateful that we get to talk, because I reached out to you when you announced it, and I said, look, it's whenever you're ready, whenever you want to, it'd be great to come and celebrate the stuff that you've done. And I'm genuinely delighted that one of the few interviews you're doing is here. So thank you for that. But talk to us a bit about what has gone on with you, because it has been life changing.
Yeah. So maybe like 7 or 8 months ago, maybe 6 months ago, I was outside working in the yard and I got a cut on my arm, and, you know, I just bandaged it up, didn't think anything about it. And then it just wouldn't go away, and it just would get like more and more painful. And I just tried toughing it out, like, or putting like topical solutions on it or whatever. And then finally it just got unbearable, like around Thanksgiving this year. And they were like, yo, you've let this go too long. We're going to have to amputate your arm at the elbow. Not only that, but it's in your bloodstream, so we have to make sure it doesn't get to your heart. You know, it was a real scary time. Like I would, you know, I did 2 procedures in the hospital. I did, you know, I was on 24-hour antibiotics. It was just a super crazy time. And, you know, it's hard to go from, you know, being able to do everything you want physically to not, you know what I mean? Like, I just don't think people realize how much you know, like I can't like tie my shoes, you know what I'm saying? Like stuff like that. And, so it's just been like super life changing. And, you know, we were talking about stuff that I need to do to stay healthy, and like, with this, like, I have to see a surgeon, I have to see a physical therapist, occupational therapist, the guy for the prosthetic, and still see my mental health therapist, you know what I mean? Like, that was the, you know, the biggest thing for me in the hospital was, like, they would have a mental health therapist there all the time. So, because it gets super depressing. I still haven't really gone out to be around anybody. There was a show that I really wanted to attend this weekend, and I just couldn't bring myself to. to go and do it, you know what I mean? And so so it's just been a hard thing to deal with.
Why don't you want to go?
I don't know. Like, I don't, people used to see me as, you know, a locker room leader, you know, a guy that could show them or teach them whatever they needed to know. And I don't know, I just feel less than. And, you know, I've had a lot of people reach out and say, hey, like, you know, your mind, especially the last maybe 5 years, I've worked more backstage than actually on shows, you know? Like, I'm a producer at a lot of different places here. I moved up to Philadelphia to help with the CZW school. I've also helped out at the Chikara school, Cheeseburger school. You know, there's a lot of opportunities around here. And I just feel like they're seeing a lesser than of what I am, you know?
Are you aware that that's something that's how you feel and that's not how other people feel about you?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I've always been, you know, somebody that it's hard to take a compliment, you know? And so, like, when I announced everything and people were saying super nice things about me, that's not my comfort level, you know? Like, just with how I grew up with, you know, abuse, I had an abusive stepfather. So, like, those things are foreign to me. And, like, I know that. And, I've gone through therapy for about that my whole life. And so, like, now, you know, like, now I have this major life-changing event. And so now it's I also think that's why I was successful as a heel. You know what I mean? Because I don't have to listen to compliments. And you know what I mean? Like, I just get to be that guy that gets to say shit back. But, like, it's just been a difficult time, this whole thing. I didn't realize how much, I knew it was going to be difficult. And it was emotional when they told me. But I didn't realize how much you need two hands for, you know?
What was the first thing that went through your head when they told you that they'd be amputating your arm?
Like, just how am I going to live? You know what I mean? Like, how am I going to make money? How am I, you know what I mean? Like, all those things go through your head real quick. Like, you know, like, how am I going to, you know, hug somebody? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's all of that. It's, you know, or like, you know, people treat you differently, you know, like when you're at a store or something. It's all of that, like, wrapped into one. I don't even know how to place it on one thing, because it's just, you know, it's like this tsunami hits you of all the stuff that is going to be bad about it.
Since the operation, who do you feel like you've drawn inspiration from?
I'll tell you, the first person that I talked to about the whole thing was Zach Gowen. I was like, hey man, like, you know, and he's in substance abuse recovery also. He's very vocal about it. But I was like, how do I, because I knew I was gonna have to address it, you know what I mean? But he helped me write my statement and gave me really good words of encouragement. I've known Zach since his first day when he came to TNA. So I've known him for a long time. And so that was super helpful. You know, like, my students have been super helpful. My girlfriend has been amazing. She does everything she can to help me. It's just, and I've had so many people reach out and just say super nice things, like D'Lo Brown, Jerry Lynn, just everybody. And then people doing, like, super generous things, like Chris Jericho donated to my GoFundMe, and I don't have, like, a close relationship with him, you know what I mean? Like, stuff like that has been really awesome.
Was that did it just appear one day? Because Chris Jericho actually did something similar for, I don't know how familiar you are with Puff. We had Puff on the show last year, and he said when he was in a car accident, Chris Jericho did something similar, just to, you know, just looking out for other boys, hang in there, take that, and rest up.
Yeah, it just came out of nowhere. I've had like some amazing friends in pro wrestling, like Kevin Owens. Like, he's just, you know, sent stuff to me before, no questions asked. Like, you know, just everybody's been like super awesome. Even people that like, you know, don't have a great reputation in pro wrestling have been amazing, you know? And like, that's awesome to know that, like, because of our relationship, they can do amazing, you know, cool things. But, you know, I wish more people would understand, like, what happens, you know, like, we're this fraternity, and, like, there's some bad eggs in it, but, like, when the chips are down, like, everybody comes together, you know? And I've always felt like that's happened in pro wrestling.
Do you think you'll learn to take compliments better in 2021? Since there's so many now.
I'm trying to.
Yeah.
I'm trying to. You know, like the most, my student Jordan Oliver did an interview that's out, you know, that they released the video of, and he talked about our relationship. And like, that's something that's really special to me, is like the students that I've trained, you know, knowing how to be positive in pro wrestling too.
I think I speak for wrestling in general when I tell you what you already know. There's a lot of love for you, Jimmy. There's a lot of love.
I appreciate it.
Before we get to, we drifted off course, but I want to end it on a high, and I want to give you some wonderful memories to reflect upon with wrestling, because we've got one more match for our DVD. We forgot about the whole premise of the show. You have, so far, we have a belter between AJ Styles and Christopher Daniels. We have Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart from WrestleMania. What is your third and final match going to be, Jimmy Ray?
The blow-off to the CZW Ring of Honor feud, the Cage of Death that they did.
Now, that was a really cool inter-promotional bit of goodness, that was.
It was amazing. And, like, you know, at the time, I was wrestling for both promotions. And it was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen. And like, it goes back to Gabe's genius booking about how that all went down. You know, even the moment where Samoa Joe, you know, has somebody up for the muscle buster and Brian Danielson takes his knee out, like, just amazing things like that. Like, it was an amazing, like, and being there that night was insane.
As you were in both camps, for both sides of this story being told, what was the discussion like that built up this interpromotional rivalry? Was it pretty straightforward of storytelling? Was everybody fairly even, or was there were there creative collisions along the way?
I mean, if you talk to, you know, I'm in the CZW office now, you know, and I know they felt like they got jaded in the whole thing, but if you watch the feud, CZW was up the whole time until the end, you know, and it's on them to capitalize off of that. You know what I mean? Like, the amazing thing I've had in pro wrestling is learning from different bookers, you know. Like, I would bug Gabe with questions. I'd bug Dutch Mantel with questions, or Jeff Jarrett. I'd even bug the Ginki Haraguchi, who was booking for Dragon Gate. I'd bug him. I bug Jado and Gato when I worked for New Japan, all that stuff. And so learning how to do this was amazing. And, like, both companies could have came out much better after that, but I don't think CZW capitalized on the momentum that they had going on. you know, like they feel that Ring of Honor just sold all their fans, which was, you know, it just showed them a different company. And like, but I know that there was some creative disagreements, but you know, in the end, when they would go with Gabe's philosophy, it was awesome. Like I remember times where Gabe would tell like myself or CM Punk that he would never book Chris Hero, you know, and then Chris became such a huge part of the company.
So you see all that going on as well. And from that particular match, the one that you've chosen, the big blow off to the interpromotional war, what spot from that match, what moment from that match do you recall that is a particular favorite of yours?
Yeah, the moment where Brian Danielson turns is a big one. And then Homicide's entrance was huge. And then when he gave Nate Webb the cop killer on the barbed wire, like all that stuff was awesome. There was just so many moments where, you know, like it just took you on the best roller coaster ever.
Can you see a similar thing going down in wrestling when we get back to whatever normal is going to be, something interpromotional of that kind of energy?
Yeah. I mean, like if AEW continues to work as they have with other promotions, it could work. But I think you know, sometimes I think people's prides get in the way too much, you know, especially like how I was saying, like CZW was beating our guys so often. Not every company is going to let you do that, you know? But you know, I know Gabe Sapolsky helps out with NXT now and he can make that work. Like I've learned, just like the old cliche is like never say never in pro wrestling, because like crazy things happen all the time that I don't ever see happening.
Absolutely. As we go into 2021, what are some of your goals for this year, Jimmy?
My goal, like, you know, my first goal is to, you know, continue to stay positive, continue to deal with all these doctor's appointments and therapy. I'd really like to get the prosthetic arm this year. I didn't realize how much that is, how expensive that is. My, you know, one of the goals is to get back in the swing of being around people, like going to shows, you know, training people, that kind of stuff. And just reconnecting with a lot of people I haven't spoken to in a while.
Well, we wish you nothing but the best for 2021. Here's for all of us and for yourself, most importantly, here's to brighter days ahead, big things to come. Where can people go to keep up with everything you're up to, Jimmy?
Yeah, I think the best place is just my Twitter. It's at the Jimmy Rave. The same thing on Instagram. Yeah, those are the best places to probably catch me.
Jimmy Rave, thanks for coming on. Here is to a healthy and happy 2021.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
For all the wrestling headlines in just 10 minutes, search Cultaholic Wrestling News on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.